Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are writer, naturalist, documentary scriptwriter, Cy Montgomery. It's always great to have her here on the show. And with her is Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. She's a writer on anthropology and animals, wild and domestic. And we're talking about their new book. It's a collection of essays, Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. Elizabeth and Cy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Pleasure is ours.
Yes, thank you.
I have to ask you, and you talk about this in the book, how did the two of you meet? Because I will say this, you have different voices. It's not like you're the same people at all. And I can definitely tell an essay by Elizabeth versus an essay by Cy. How did the two of you meet, and how did you decide to get together and have your adventures?
Oh, well, we have been friends for, we figured out it was 32 or 33 years.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, certainly over three decades.
Yeah.
And Liz was one of the first, well, she was, I think, the first friend that I made when my husband Howard and I moved to New Hampshire. And Howard actually read an article about Liz in the local paper, because Liz had worked with Katie Payne, her very good friend, in Namibia on the paper announcing the discovery of infrasound in elephants, that elephants can communicate across vast distances. And the paper had this story about her, and Howard said, "You've got to meet this woman." And at the time, I was writing, I had just moved here, and I had started writing a column for the New Hampshire Times. So I pitched a profile on Elizabeth Marshall Thomas to the paper, and therefore had my foot in the door. So I called up, and she let me come over.
Oh, and, how sweet! It's actually great. That's a great
we
story.
We clicked, and I met her dogs and her husband, and told her that we had ferrets. And Liz immediately wanted to see them. I said, "Well, when?" She said, "Now." So we rushed over to the house. And my ferrets at the time, you know, I had just come back from living for 6 months in the Australian outback studying emus. When I left, I'd had, oh gosh, I guess three or four ferrets. And when I got back, I had a lot more of them. And they were pretty wild, because the person that was taking care of them, it turned out, was allergic to them. So as these babies were growing up, they didn't get to have much contact with people. So the minute Liz reaches in to greet the ferrets, you know, one of them chomps onto her finger, and I apologize profusely, and she's like, "Oh, no, don't be upset at all. It's fine that I'm being bitten by a weasel."
I concur. I would love to be bitten by a weasel.
Yeah.
I feel the same way when I get bitten by snakes all the time. I'll be leading a field trip, and, you know, I'll pick up a black eraser to show the group, and it'll be biting me all over the place. And first of all, it doesn't hurt. And people are like freaking out. You're getting bitten by a snake. And it's like, nah, it's no big deal. It's not like
right,
you're bitten
right.
by a lion or something like that. God, no.
Ferret bites don't hurt very much either.
So. No.
Nothing to it.
I want to talk to Elizabeth for a moment. Elizabeth, how long have you dedicated your life to looking at wildlife and also domestic animals and their relationship to people? It seems like your entire life has been dedicated to that. How did that start?
Well, it started with I was born into a family with a Newfoundland dog and two cats.
Huh.
And I mean, they were fascinating. The Newfoundland acted as my nanny. She wouldn't let me or my brother go near the, when we would go to the beach in the summer, she wouldn't let us go near the water. She was very strict about it, and also crossing streets, she didn't let us cross streets. And by this time I was tall enough so that if she was sitting down and I was standing up, we would be face to face and we would look into each other's eyes. And she, you could see that she meant business, and you didn't go against what she said. And, then as I grew up and much older, I realized that people didn't think that dogs had thoughts and feelings.
That's right.
But, I mean, I was aghast to hear people saying that, because, of course, they do. And, I mean, very clearly. Also, the cats were very interesting. The cats in the basement, they lived down there, and cats would come in from the street through a cat door. And they our cats weren't neutered, weren't spayed, and they would, the ones who came in were males who were their suitors, and they would, it was, I would just sit down there and listen to them and watch them. It was very easy to go from there to wild animals. Animals were very interesting. Mysterious lives that you don't quite understand. And they're not like human lives, but they're sort of parallel to human lives in an interesting way. And then we had a farm in New Hampshire with where I live now. And there were deer and foxes and
wow,
many kinds of animals, and it's hard if you're exposed to animals of any kind, it's hard not to be interested.
I totally identify with that, and it's interesting. Both of you sort of paralleled this concern about how other creatures other than humans think and how they can express emotions. It seems like there's definitely an interior life of most animals that I know, but it's not the same life. We have to be really careful about being anthropomorphic about it because it's a different life from ours. And Cy, I particularly think about the book on the octopus. I mean, that was the closest thing to meeting an alien from another planet.
Yes, yes. I mean, you really would have to go to outer space or science fiction to find anyone more different from a human than an octopus.
But there was
you
an intelligence there.
One.
I know. Do you know that changed what I eat?
Really?
Yeah, I'm not. I will no longer ever eat calamari or octopus ever again.
Wow!
Because of that book, to me it was uncontestable that there was an intelligence there.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That was a different kind of intelligence. It was a very alien intelligence. But I oftentimes worry that people start to try to pigeonhole animal lives into our way of thinking. Either of you ever find that that's a problem?
Hmm. Well, I find sometimes people like to think of animals as little people in fursuits.
Right, exactly.
Right, Liz?
Yeah, right.
And, you know, they think of their dogs and cats as their babies, and, you know, they get a baby bird and they try to give it milk. I mean, that kind of stuff doesn't work. But as wacko as that can seem in a lot of contexts, I think it's even more wacko to deny that animals have thoughts and feelings.
That's
their
right.
Thoughts and feelings
right.
Aren't the same as ours. I mean, they aren't thinking about what they're going to wear. They're not worried about the deadline getting in their book submission on time. But many of their concerns are similar to ours. Their senses, though, are very different. And
that's
so
right.
The way their thoughts are coming to them are along different sensory pathways. As Henry Beston said, you know, they are living by voices that we cannot hear. They are gifted with extensions of the senses that we have lost or never attained. So, you know, I cannot taste with all of my skin, including my eyelids, like an octopus. I can't shed my skeleton like a tarantula. I can't pull my leg off and eat it when I hurt my foot. But other animals can.
Damn them.
Yeah, I know. Wouldn't you just love to do that?
I would so love to be able to do that. Liz, you said a great thing in one of the essays in this book. Cars are the internet of dogs, and tires are their social media. I totally rolled on the floor when I read that. You have to explain that to the audience, what you mean by that.
Well, as most of us with dogs know, dogs sniff the tires of cars and lift their legs on the car. I think this is city dogs. I had country dogs and city dogs, and my country dogs weren't particularly interested in cars at all. They were interested in what was out in the woods and what was going around in the fields and stuff like that. But I recently got adopted two dogs who had grown up in cities, and they are interested only in car tires. And when I go, because another dog has peed on them.
That's right.
They, And then they pee on the tire. But I mean, they get messages from dogs far away, and
oh my God,
by smelling the tires, and that's what they're obsessed with, that, and it's that's what, and I'm sure they do send messages, but they can't quite tell where the other dog is from. but they would know if they had been to the place where the car went, they would know what it smelled like. I mean, they're very good at things like that. I once adopted another dog from a shelter, and took him for a little walk to see how we'd get along together, and we walked. Huh. He was on a leash, and we walked around through the parking lot. There must have been 50 or 60 cars there, and when we passed my car, which he had never seen before, and he stopped, and he sat down, and he looked at me. Are we going in this car? Huh. So he knew that the car was mine.
He could smell you in the car.
Pardon me?
He could smell you on the car, probably?
He smelled me on the car, yeah. He smelled the car and knew from the scent of the car that it was mine. I never pee on the tires, but
that was my next question. Thank you for that, Elizabeth, because I needed to know that. you're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are writer, naturalist, and documentary scriptwriter and friend of WICN, Cy Montgomery. It's always great to have her on the show. And Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. She's a writer on anthropology and animals, wild and domestic. And we're talking about their new book. It's a collection of essays. It's called Tamed and Untamed: Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. I want to ask you, both of you have written regular-sized books. Is it hard to write in the short form and get everything down that you want to say in a short thing? Sure.
I didn't find it difficult because I was trained as a journalist. That's when I started.
Okay.
What about you, Liz?
That explains
you never
it.
Seem to have any trouble doing this.
No, I kind of like it. You can you know that the subject you're going to write about is limited, so you don't have to worry about how it connects with other stuff in the book you might write. So you can just do a single subject, and I think it's kind of, I like it. It's nice.
I want to ask you each in turn about different essays that you wrote, that a lot of these really stuck with me, but I want to, several very much stuck with me. You wrote a great essay, Cy, about snakes. You were, and I'm really jealous of you, you were at the snake den in Manitoba, Canada.
Oh, you would love that so
Oh, my
much.
God,
You'd
I would not
right
want to
at
leave.
Home.
I've seen smaller snake dens of different garter snakes sort of come out in the spring. And that's been that's amazing to see.
Most of us feel lucky if we get to see a single snake on any given day.
Any day I see a snake is a good day.
I feel that way too. But to be able to see 18,000 snakes at glance is like a dream come true.
I know. I totally get that. Why are so many people afraid of snakes? And Elizabeth, you can chime in too. Do you think it's instinctual, or is it learned, or is it a combination?
Well, in my essay, I take this on because people have looked into this to see whether we're born with a fear of snakes. And we are not born with a fear of snakes, it appears. However, the ability to learn to fear snakes is inherited. We learn that very easily. We have an inherent ability to learn quickly to fear snakes and spiders. And the reason for that, it would seem, is that our ancestors, even when our ancestors were living in the trees, were hunted by many large snakes that would feed on them. So it would behoove you to be able to get that search image and get out of the way, be inspired to get out of the way of a big snake if you were a primate living in Africa. Now, here in North America, we don't have many dangerous snakes, and certainly not here in the Northeast. I mean, you would be so lucky
to
see a rattlesnake. I mean, there are a few of them, but that's it.
I've actually actively searched for both of the copperhead and the rattlesnake, and I've yet to see one.
No. I mean, boy, you'd be really lucky to see them.
Right.
What we have here are, you know, mostly you're likely to see a garter snake or a milk snake.
Right.
Both of which are harmless, even though the milk snake tries to pretend that it's a rattlesnake. And it, even though it doesn't have a rattle, it'll try, it'll whack its tail around in the leaves and try to make
That's
it
right.
a rattlesnake.
That's right.
And they also try to pretend that they're aggressive, and they'll even strike at you, but nothing will happen.
Yeah, they don't open their mouth really a lot.
Yeah.
My favorite one is the hognose snake, and we have a nice population at North Quabbin here. And when they see you, they'll coil and hiss incredibly loudly. They'll hiss like a tea kettle.
Oh my gosh!
And they swell up their head, so they look sort of like a weird cobra. And then they'll strike. They never open their mouth. And it's a hefty snake. It's a big snake. And then if you don't fall for that, and this is the amazing thing, and I got a chance to see this, they flip over and play dead.
Wow, that's great.
And so if you flip them back, if you flip them back over, they flip back over again.
Really?
And
they're going to try it again. Well, yeah, I mean, who's to say these guys don't have a theory of mind? They're trying to figure out, like, this other organism, what do I have to do to it to make it leave me alone?
Mm.
Well, let me try and get it to leave. Oh, that didn't work by scaring it away. So let me see if I can make it leave by making the other organism believe I'm actually dead already.
but to make it to know you don't I the snake doesn't have a dangerous venom. But it knows that other snakes do, or it knows that people are scared if a snake strikes.
Yep, I don't know how that all works out. But
you know, that's pretty good.
Yeah,
and it's pretty convincing. I'll tell you, it's really if you ever watch one of these. I'm a person who loves snakes, and your first reaction is, whoa. It's like, okay.
That's so cool.
It is cool. By the way, that impulse in me gets me in a lot of trouble in other countries like Australia, where my first impulse is to try to pick a snake up.
What happened?
That's stories for other times. Liz, I want to talk to you about cat vandalism, because I'm a person who has three indoor cats.
Yes.
And I really loved that essay because basically you start out by going, yeah, cats are going to vandalize your house. Just live with it.
Yeah, just live with it, yeah. Well, I mean, why have cats if you don't enjoy them?
That's right.
And if you enjoy them, what do you care more about yourself or about your cat? And the answer is your cat. So, yeah.
Now,
and you get used to it. You get used to the way your house looks, and it really doesn't matter.
It really doesn't. Thank you. And I'm so glad you wrote that essay. Now, another essay you wrote that was a tough sell for me was In Praise of Tiny Dogs. I always thought, you know, regular dogs, okay, but this plethora of small, tiny dogs, it's a tough sell to me. Talk to me about why tiny dogs are great.
Well, what happened was that I had a 50-year culture of middle-sized dogs.
Yeah.
And the older dogs taught the younger dogs. And they, I mean, border collie size, husky size, and most recently Australian cattle dogs. And they were wonderful. And But when the last one died, I thought, I mean, I'm in my 80s, and I thought, if I get another dog, I will predecease it, so I won't get another dog.
Right.
And my daughter said, well, no, go ahead and get a dog, and if you predecease it, that she would take care of the dog.
Oh, nice.
And I thought, well, that was nice, so I go to the shelter, and there were two little dogs in a cage, and she didn't say, don't get two little dogs, so... So I did, I would have gotten a larger dog except for that, and I was quite surprised at how interesting they are, and they're really quite different from the older dogs. They're fascinated by scent. They're city dogs. They were city dogs, so they're fascinated by tires, and they walk on pavement if they can rather than on grass and leaves, and they're interested only in things that would have come from a town or a city. They have very little interest in what's going on in the woods.
Wow.
And, I mean, they don't... Well, I don't take them out there. The little one is so small. He's smaller than a cat. He weighs about 10 pounds, 9 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And his feet are big as dimes, the size of dimes. And, I mean, he's... But he's you know, he's very smart. He's very dog-like. He's very courageous. You know about running deer, that it's illegal
yep.
for dogs to chase
yep.
deer?
Yeah.
Well, he did.
Well, he's also fearless. He chased the sky.
He's fearless. He's fearless, and he challenges everything.
Wow.
He challenged the thunder, even.
He challenges the thunder. He challenged a low-flying plane. He challenged. He ran right out and got it. And he doesn't know he's small. Well, he must know he's small, but it doesn't seem to faze him. They're very different from larger dogs. Larger dogs. Well, that's hard to say. I don't know if they're different from larger dogs. They came from a city. My other dogs more or less grew up in the country, and
right.
they were country dogs, or they became country dogs. And but they're both very interesting. The Chihuahua, the littlest one, he's very hard to train. He doesn't want to do what you want him to do. He wants you to do what he wants.
That sounds like
and,
my cat.
And when we go to bed, he stands. I lie down on the bed, and he stands on top of me. And if I don't pat him, he threatens me. He shows me his teeth.
Whoa. So this is a case where the dog has trained the owner.
The dog has trained the owner. That's right. Exactly.
Okay. We're going to run out of time. There's so many other essays I want to talk about. Si, I got to talk to you about the Christmas ermine, because just for the first time this year in January in the town of Peru, Massachusetts, I saw my first ermine. And it's an amazing experience. And I read this essay of yours. And it really captured that incredible experience of seeing an ermine. Talk to the people who don't know what an ermine is, what it is.
Well, an ermine is what we call the white-coated winter version of a weasel. And it looks, I mean, it's whiter than the whitest snow.
Yeah.
And coal black eyes. And when I saw this ermine, it was Christmas Day, and I had just taken down to my chickens, who I raised from babies, and they love me, and I love them, and we recognize each other and talk to each other. And so for breakfast on Christmas Day, I bring them a big bowl of hot popcorn. So I'd opened the door to their coop to bring them their Christmas treat, and I saw one of my chickens dead on the floor. And I went to pick her up, and someone had a hold of her head. And I pulled and pulled, and I saw who had her head. It was this ermine. And there was blood on his white face. And he popped out of this little hole in the corner of the coop and looked at me, this monster who weighed thousands of times what he weighed, and looked at me like, give me back my chicken. And I could not believe the courage of the animal.
Oh, yeah.
And the energy that you could feel. I mean, when you saw the ermine, did you also feel this incredible, frenetic?
They're like on several cups of coffee.
Yes.
They're going about their business, and they are fearless. I mean, I've led groups of people out into the woods, and we'll come across a weasel, not the ermine, not the winter pelage, but when it sees us, sometimes they'll actually just stand on top of the wall and stomp their feet.
Yeah.
And
what are you doing messing
right?
with my territory?
It's like, get out of here. And it's like, wow, this is little weasel.
I know. And it's, you know, I guess what struck me on that Christmas Day, one of the wonderful Christmas presents that I got meeting that animal.
It's absolutely.
It was such a beautiful and inspiring sight that even though this animal had killed someone who I loved.
And you do love your chickens. You've written about your chickens.
Yeah. They're smart. I mean, people don't realize how smart chickens are, that they remember 100 different faces quite easily, that they have their own words for things. They make up words, including names for us. You know, these are smart animals, and this is someone who I had known for years and had history with, and this ermine had just killed her. And yet, I could feel no anger and no animosity towards that creature.
Right.
There was no evil in that creature. There was nothing but perfection.
It's a beautiful animal. It's absolutely amazing. Now, we only have a few minutes left, and Liz, you wrote an essay, and I need people to read this. It's about feeding deer, and Fish and Wildlife tells you not to feed deer. But you, under certain circumstances, and you have to stick with it, you can feed deer. But it was at the end of the essay that you wrote this that really, really stuck with me. It says, why help wildlife anyway? I do it because we're so happy to damage them. Talk about that. That was, to me, that was the big takeaway for this whole book, was that phrase right there.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah,
we seem to go out of our way to do what we can to harm animals.
Yeah.
So why not feed them?
Why not feed them? Yeah. And feeding them, well, if you feed them carefully and if you know what you're doing, you will not harm them. I mean, mine were not harmed. Several years of deer feeding didn't harm any deer, as far as I know. I mean, the same deer would be there in the spring that were there in the fall, if you could recognize them individually.
But the timing is important, right?
And the timing, yeah. And with this new weather, when, I mean, here we are almost in December and it's warm here in New Hampshire.
Yeah,
not warm, but it's not freezing. They can still eat their sort of version of their summer foods. So what's happening, I mean, their intestines adjust to winter diet. And if to a different diet for winter for them, and if you give them rich foods, that can damage them. And if they eat a lot of it, it can kill them. If they eat a lot
of it
at once, it can kill them. And so you have to feed them carefully and start at the right time. And you don't want to start during hunting season because you don't want them coming looking for food when there are hunters out hunting them.
That's right.
And you have to do the timing, but so far I've been successful.
We're gonna have to cut it off there. We could talk about these essays till the cows come home, and crawl into bed with us. My guests tonight are writer, naturalist, documentary scriptwriter Cy Montgomery, and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, writer on anthropology and animals, wild and domestic. And they have a wonderful new book called Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters with the Animal Kind. There are essays on keeping slugs as pets, water bears, hyraxes, puffins, you name it. It's all in this book. Elizabeth and Cy, it's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Pleasure's ours all the time.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.